Value the unique contributions that individuals from traditionally underrepresented and oppressed communities bring to our organization and encourage these individuals to apply.
Here we are.
The New Spins Library.
Here we are.
Hey, Montreal. It's a great day out there. Welcome to the New Spins Library on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have an arts and culture extravaganza for you today of pre-recorded interviews from 2022. The first interview is with Brian Sellers of Media School. High school-aged children are in for a big treat this year in Media School, where they will build their imaginations and let their self-expression go wild. The second interview we'll share with Eric Janvier for his film work, Heartbeat of a Nation. The last interview will be Daphne Boyer. In 2022, Daphne Boyer held an art exhibition at the MAI. She can still be found. Listen to her interview before 8 o'clock. We'll listen to Democracy Now!, 818 Brings Weather, and after some music, we'll listen to the podcast called In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, where this week's question is, why do we like roller coasters? After some more music, we'll wrap up the show. Let's start the day off with some music.
Touch me.
Good morning, McGill University. This is Todor O telling you that CKUT has some of the coolest artists and tunes you can find anywhere in Canada. Present company certainly not excluded. You are listening to the New Spins Library on CKUT 90.3 FM. The songs you're about to hear will go towards your final grade, so I hope you're writing this down.
From reconnecting with old friends, to getting new clothes and supplies, to having a new teacher, back to school can be an exciting time for students. This fall, the National Film Board of Canada is adding to that excitement with Media School, a new online filmmaking program for students between the ages of 13 and 18 to tell their story. Led by their teachers through the NFB education portal, Campus, students now have a whole new way to share their experiences and learn about media production. The program is directed and edited by filmmaker and education enthusiast Paul Tom, who is the on-screen mentor and has been involved in the project since its early stages. With us today, we have Brian Sellors of the National Film Board of Canada. Hi, Brian, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you became involved in Media School by the National Film Board of Canada.
My name is Brian Sellors, and I'm an instructional designer and course developer at the Film Board. So I feel like it was really kind of a case of right place at the right time. At the time, I was at Concordia, finishing my master's degree in educational technology. And at the same time, the Film Board was switching from having workshops in person to having workshops online. So there was a position that became available and I applied, and luckily I got the position and I've been working there ever since. And that was 6 years ago.
Who are your teammates at the National Film Board of Canada? And how did you coordinate Media School?
I work with Marc-André Roy, who's also an instructional designer, like myself. He's a friend and colleague. We've been working together ever since I've been at the Film Board. There's also Stephanie Lazur. She is responsible for some of the writing as well as coordinating the translation of the course because it's available in both French and English. And then we also have Dan Thornhill, who's a really close friend. Unfortunately, he passed away about a year and a half ago due to lung cancer, but his involvement in the course has been substantial and he's responsible for creating so many of the cool interactive activities that we have.
What is Media School?
Media School is basically this online platform that hosts the digital storytelling course. And if you don't know what a digital story is, well, essentially it's a short video that's made up of images, music, sound effects, and most importantly, a narration. This course basically takes students from the production process all the way from A to Z, starting with what is a digital story, understanding the medium a little bit more, to finding a topic, to conducting research, presenting that to a classroom, and even getting into the production within an editing software. So it goes through the whole process.
How easy is it to access Media School?
It's really easy to access. All you have to do is go to nfb.ca/education/Media School. And essentially there's a button to click on workshops and then you have access to the course.
Is it only for 13 to 18 year olds, or can anyone access Media School through the NFB?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think It's generally meant for teachers. I guess it's useful for teaching campus. But what I would say is that anybody technically can access it, because if you go to the link that I mentioned before, there's a trial button. If you click on that, then anyone can access the course.
You're partnered with the Nation's Center for Truth and Reconciliation. What will you be doing together?
Yeah, actually, last Monday, I gave a workshop. And the goal for the workshop was basically to help students create a digital story. And they were tasked with answering this question, which was, what does reconciliation mean to me? And they have to basically produce a 2-minute video answering that question. So what I did is I took them through different parts of the digital storytelling course, and to help them be able to tell a better story and give them the tools that would be able to create one.
What will the NFB be looking for from the students, and how will Media School promote future film production in Canada?
I think what we want, what we're looking for students the most, is really to give them a chance to have their voices heard. So, you know, NFB Education's going to be putting out calls for completed projects. We're also going to be inviting teachers and students to share their stories on social media using the hashtag Media School. And I think in terms of promoting production, what we really want to do is that there's so much know-how at the NFB that we've been doing cinema otar for over 30 years. So it's like there's all these, we have animators, we have documentary filmmakers. We want to kind of democratize that know-how, how what we know about creating films, and to be able to share that with students and Canadians.
If our listeners want more information about Media School or the National Film Board of Canada, where should they go?
For anything, you can go to nfb.ca, and specifically for Media School, it would be nfb.ca/education/Media School.
Thank you for your interview today.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Brian Sellers speaking about the National Film Board of Canada and Media School by Paul Thom. I am your hostess, Sheila Ferrando.
Donna didn't come into the office today?
No, she's got a fever.
Aww, that's so thoughtful.
A woman of principle.
She even wears a mask to the mall and washes her hands for like 20 seconds.
Ugh, some people are just too perfect.
And when she has a sore throat, cough, or runny nose, she wears a mask too.
Aww. I can't believe it.
Talk about considerate.
I'm touched.
She can have my office chair.
She can have my office.
For everyone's good, let's adopt proper habits against the viruses. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
I've done the kind of love where you burn out, mess each other up, and get a rundown. But being with you feels so old school. Let's try not to rush in like fools. I wanna slow dance, talk all night, watch the sky. We can just hold hands, throw it back, give me that record store romance with no plans and nowhere to be. Come on and slow. Out. Pour a glass of Cabernet and let you spin me round. There's something so sweet about those old melodies. So honey, pull me close and find.
about the songs you sing. Hey, my mind, I feel like a caged horse this time. Oh, I can feel my hope again. It's where I belong. And all my grief is healed by the love I seek. And all my life I've known, you're only as good as the air you breathe. And I'll be gone, but I'll be home. You're only as good as the songs you sing. Sick of my soul, I need to feel my heart again. I'm lost when there's low tides, but I can see the road again. It's where I belong. Oh, all my life I've known, you're only as good as the air you breathe. And I'll be gone, but I'll be home. As good as the songs you sing. Ah, the songs you sing. Ah, all my life I've known, you're only as good as the air you breathe. And I'll be gone, but I'll be home.
Sing.
In the Northern Alberta community of Chipewyan Prairie Den First Nation, a father teaches his child how to create a caribou drum. In this short documentary, cultural reclamation and traditional knowledge are celebrated and passed down from one generation to the next, inspiring renewed hope for the future. The film had its world premiere at the 2022 Calgary International Film Festival and has screened at festivals in Canada and the U.S. With us today, we have Eric Janvier, Northwest Studio filmmaker of Heartbeat of a Nation. Hi, Eric, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be a filmmaker inspired to produce Heartbeat of a Nation.
So again, my name is Eric Janvier. I'm originally from Fort McMurray, Alberta, currently living in Edmonton. And, you know, I've always been interested in film and television and just creating stories and crafting stories. And that's and kind of how I ended up here in this, you know, in this industry. And then over the years, I've kind of created, I made a name for myself, and the National Film Board had reached out to me asking for content or some kind of idea. And I threw them a bunch of different stuff. And then eventually we landed on Heartbeat of a Nation because, you know, this story to me was more personal.
What is the story you want to tell in Heartbeat of a Nation?
For me, the story being so personal, I really wanted to tell my family's history and my family's personal connection to the caribou drum. And so when I first conceived the idea, it wasn't really a focus on my family. It was more so a focus on the drum. But as things kind of moved forward, and I really started to come to the conclusion that if I'm going to tell this story, I need to tell it from my point of view and my family's point of view, not somebody else's. So that's kind of how things came about.
How is this Heartbeat of a Nation of personal importance to you?
Yeah, again, this is my family's story, and it's, you know, the two people or the three people that are shown in my documentary are my brother, my nephew, and my auntie. And so me and my brothers, we're a drum group, and we have been carrying on or sharing our knowledge and our traditions with different communities. And we've really been, you know, carrying the drum for the past decade and reintroducing it back into our community.
What is the importance of caribou and the caribou drum to your community?
For us, the caribou was always a subsistence. It was what our ancestors would rely on for food and for warmth. And, you know, from there, that's where the drum was created. And obviously over time, over the last few decades, the woodland caribou were native to where I'm from. They've really been dwindling in size. Where there used to be thousands, you're lucky if you can spot one in anywhere. The caribou drum, especially how it's kind of making its return in our area of the world, it's kind of symbolizing a return to our culture and to our shared histories. And it's really just a way for us to reconnect with who we are as Dene people.
What do you want the audience to take away from this film?
For the Indigenous communities that watch this, the Indigenous audience, I really want them to stand and to know that it's never too late or it's never too early to learn your culture. We've got my brother, who's 38 at the time of filming. He just started picking up the drum not too long ago, whereas my nephew, who at the time was eight or nine, he also ended up just picking up the drum not too long ago. So it's never too early or too late to really relearn or to take on your culture. And then for the non-Indigenous community, I really want them to see us as we are and not what we used to be, and how we're modernizing a lot of our cultural aspects and a lot of our traditions. And you see that in the documentary where my brother is using power tools instead of traditional tools, woodworking tools. Yeah, so the story I really want to tell is my family connection to the drum and how important it is to my community, and not just my community, but surrounding communities and, you know, ones that maybe aren't as connected to the drum, and they can see that we, you know, started picking up the drum not too long ago and that we're really carrying it and playing the drum and creating our drums and crafting our drums. So I really wanted to tell that story of how we're connected to this drum and how we're sharing the knowledge and the stories with our elders and our youth and with everybody involved.
Who plays in the film and what does everyone do?
My brother and my nephew and my auntie. So my brother is the one that is really crafting the drum, and he's making a drum for himself and for my nephew, August. And August really he's there and he's watching, he's learning and experiencing how to make a drum. And this is the first drum that August had ever made with my brother. And so really getting to see the dynamic between those two and seeing how August is taking in the knowledge, even if at times he does look like he's bored. And then my auntie, who actually wasn't supposed to be there, we were just filming on her property and she was in the background. And there's a really important moment in the documentary that wasn't scripted. It wasn't, I didn't provoke it. And she just saw what was happening and really spoke from the heart. And that's one of those moments in that people really talk about when they talk about this documentary.
May we hear some audio from the program?
Yep.
This is Heartbeat of a Nation on CKUT.
When and where will you show the film Heartbeat of a Nation?
We are still playing festivals, but we are doing a release in mid-January online, so it'll be accessible to all communities across Canada. It'll be on the National Film Board of Canada website as well as YouTube, I believe. They will be able to see it online in the next coming weeks here.
If our listeners want more information, where should they go?
They can go to the National Film Board of Canada website and search up Heartbeat of a Nation. You'll find all the information there. You can find when it'll be screening online, and you can find all the biography of the filmmakers involved and who was involved and everything like that.
Thank you for your interview today.
Yeah, no, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Eric Janvier speaking about his film Heartbeat of a Nation. I'm your host, Sheila Ferrando.
It's all CKUT, where the new spins beat. Liberate, we prove the true meaning of libraries. The world out some station for the community that news, arts, and culture shape our intellectuality. Releasing these new spins, during these bright grins, Wednesday morning, 7 to 9 on 90.3 is where it's happening. Tune in, the tunes are in tune, and with some interviewing, the new spins library Wednesday, 7 a.m. is broadcast. The new spins library. The new spins library. The new spins library. The new spins.
September 8th to October 8th, 2022, MAI, the Montreal Arts Interculturel, presents FAC, an exhibition of recent works by Métis visual artist Daphne Boyer. This is an opportunity to discover a rich and vibrant body of work that combines plant matter and traditional Indigenous techniques. The vernissage will take place on Thursday, September 8th at 5 p.m., With us today, we have Daphne Boyer. Hi, Daphne, and welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you?
Who is Daphne Boyer, and what kind of art do you do?
I am Métis by birth. My mother was the Métis person in our family. My ancestors were two of the first 300 French colonists to arrive in Jaujague, which is now known as Montreal. So that sort of started the story from the colonial perspective in terms of our Métis ancestry. As my mother always said, that our ancestors, some of the ancestors arrived on the boat and some of them met the boat. So the ones that met the boat were Indigenous people, and they formed Indigenous women. And unfortunately, we have only their first names, and often those names would not have been, they would have been assigned names We have the names of their partners and the time that their unions were formed, but they were Ojibwe women, women of Gauvin, and also they were Soto women. And my ancestors were founding members of the first Métis nation in what is now known as Manitoba. So the family history follows the fur trade along the fur trade route with the coureurs de bois and voyageurs right into what is now known as Manitoba. And my art is a combination, as you already said, of traditional techniques, but with a whole new spin on it. What I've done is in the last 3 or 4 years, and I should mention that I've come very late in life to art making, but I've invented photographic ways of producing works that mirror women's traditional handwork. This is Indigenous women. And initially, Indigenous women used quills, porcupine quills, as a way to adorn gear and clothing and household objects. And they also used what's called moose tufting or caribou tufting, which basically is the soft down on under the hairy coat of the animal is dyed and then clipped into small tufts and then stitched into wool or into hide to make these wonderful colored little mounds that were often floral in design. And what I've done is I've created photo-based techniques to mirror these two the quill work and the moose tufting and as well the beading technique. So I've photographed hundreds of berries in a very specific technique that I've developed and created a digital bead box from which I've made multiple works. And the beauty of these works are that each individual berry can be enlarged to the size of your head. So they're scalable. I can make a small work that can be blown up into large size. And I'm very keen on making big works because I really want to make space for the stories that these works carry.
Who works with you as a collaborator?
My right hand is Lena Samokova. So up until 2016, I lived in Montreal, and I now live in Victoria, which is the homeland of the Lekwungen speaking peoples. I've worked remotely since before the pandemic with Lena. We've created works. So she's my main technical support. For the Fakur show here in Montreal, I've collaborated with Michelle Smith, who is a filmmaker. She's an educator. She works at teaches at Dawson. She's an academic. And together, we've put together a whole series of programs that will be part of the Dawson College Peace Week. And we are working also in conjunction with Diana Rice at Dawson College. So a lot, mostly the research is, I do the research, I come up with the concepts, and then I have a technical team as well made up of other people in Montreal, Barry Muse, and Ron DeLille, who have also been working on recent projects. You know, it is a teamwork, a team job. Partner's an excellent writer, so his hand is usually in the works as well.
Which artworks did you decide to create for this exhibition, Faku? And what do they represent?
Well, first of all, let me start out by explaining why I chose that title. So the word in English, what I'm reflecting is the idea of, you know, which is a common thing that we use when we're storytelling. And because these works are embedded with stories, many layers of stories, the French translation is fucker, which is basically something, it's a joiner, right? Which we use in segueing from one topic to the other. So the works that I created specifically for this show were suspended works because the MEI, I have a history with MEI. And here's one of the stories. MEI sponsored me in a mentorship in 2016 with an Indigenous artist and curator named France Trépanier. France was one of the original founders of the Aboriginal Curatorial Collective, and MEI saw a promise in my work and supported me in this mentorship. So France, basically, who has a lot of experience in art, drilled down into what I was doing and basically said to me, Daphne, you've got to get this work out. And by the way, while you're making it, make it big. So with that in mind, I created a number of big works to bring this that are in the show at the MEI and part of what I wanted to do was to say thank you to the Mai because of their generous support. You know, I was 60 at the time when I started making this work. Although I'd taken courses at Concordia and had always wanted to be an artist, I didn't have the so-called pedigree of an artist at that time. And they saw promise in me, supported me. And so here I am back with these big works. Both of them are suspended works, and one of them is called The Birthing Tent. And The Birthing Tent was made to honor my great-grandmother, who was an itinerant midwife on the northern Great Plains. So it's a two-part work. It has a canopy that's printed. These are textile works. It's the canopy is printed with the oxytocin molecule. So oxytocin is the bonding hormone that is stimulated between mother and baby when at the time of birth. And did I say that my grandmother was an itinerant midwife on the northern Great Plains? Yes.
Yes, okay. You did.
Yeah. Good. That part's important. So that oxytocin is present in all of us. It's the bonding hormone. It's what makes us feel connected to others, you know, human and non-human. And also it reflects the cohesive nature of the Métis community at a time when the Métis were couriers and they were hunters and trappers, as was my great-grandfather. So the tent was made in honor of Eleanor, who is my great grandmother, and she was married to a plains hunter and trader, and they lived on an outpost. Their girls were raised on that outpost, so that was my grandmother, who I knew. The tent also includes 16 ribbons that are printed with what I call my berries to beads technique. So the oxytocin molecule is actually the actual physical formulation of the molecular formulation in a ball and stick format that's printed on the roof of the tent. It looks like somewhat like a galaxy, but the atoms are all beaded with my technique, and the ribbons are also beaded, and the ribbons are my way of honoring ribbon skirts. So ribbon skirts are a rite of passage for Indigenous women. They are a symbol of resilience and a rite of passage. And they are used often to honor missing and murdered women and girls and Two-Spirit people. So this canopy carries a lot of stories in it. And there is another work that I made as well. Would you like to hear about that one?
Let's talk about that one a little later in the in the interview. What does it signify to you to be born a Métis, joining two cultures?
I think that's what people often think that Métis are. They think that it is emergence of two cultures. But actually, the Métis people, as some of the founding people of this country, weren't just a combination of two cultures. Basically, the Métis people were identified as a unique culture in that they had their own language, they had their own culture, they had their own homeland. The Great Plains was the homeland of the Métis people. It was, Mi'kmaq is the language that the Métis spoke. They were traders and they were couriers, and also many of our Métis people were known because of the buffalo hunt, which was an annual or biannual, sometimes more than that, more frequently than that in a year, where the whole communities would migrate out onto the plains. There would be buffalo for as far as the eye could see, and they would live and work on the plains, harvesting buffalo and processing meat, making pemmican, preparing hides for trade, and then they would go back to their communities in the winter. And sometimes there would be a hunt also in the winter as well. So for me, it's a very rich land-based part of my upbringing. My mother was a naturalist. She was the one that carried the stories of our ancestry. And at a time when there was very little pride associated with being an Indigenous person, I was raised in Saskatchewan and specifically grew up in Saskatoon at a time when Indigenous people were being picked up off the street by the city police and driven out into the dead of winter, dropped off, 5 miles out of town because they were told to sober up, and some of them froze to death in the process. I don't think that's news to anybody about that history. But it didn't come with a sense of pride initially. But my mother was great. She kept all of the archives. She was the one, she was one of 15 people, kids in her family. And my grandmother, who spoke Michif and had worked as a Cree and French and English interpreter as a young woman on the outpost where she was raised, she denied this ancestry. And she did it. Although I was very frustrated as a young person, I couldn't get her to talk about it with us. She did it for a good reason. Where she had been raised, her name was Clémence, and where Clémence had been raised was right adjacent to a community called Labrette in southern Saskatchewan, where the head of that, of the local residential school, which was the second one in that area to be built, was known to actually abduct children from, particularly from single parent women, and take them in, and, you know, the children would disappear into this residential school, which actually ran until the late 1990s.
When did you first decide to create bridges between Indigenous knowledge and Western science, Daphne? And how has this given you perspective on the future?
Well, to be honest with you, once again, my viewpoint is that Indigenous people have been scientists for a very long time. What is science? But having an acute sense of observation, having, you know, making a hypothesis and trying things, this is the history of the Indigenous people, whether that be in relation to plants or medicines or architecture or, you know, biology, that thousands and thousands of years spent on the land observing animals and observing the land, observing the seasons. This, from my vantage point, is Indigenous science. So it's not really a question of when did it happen. It's just, it's been there forever.
Which art techniques are you showcasing, in fact? And would you take this opportunity to talk about the last piece you wanted to tell?
I'm showcasing the techniques that I mentioned that I invented to mirror the traditional handwork of Indigenous women, which are, you know, beading, quill work, and moose tufting. And the last work that actually a work that is made up of 11 floor to ceiling banners is a work that I created using quill work designs. And these banners were inspired by a Métis sash that was finger woven by a late friend. And she did a whole series, she was a weaver, and she did a whole series of these Métis sashes. And I was inspired by her work and wanted to honor our relationship. So created large banners that are printed on silk, and the surface designs on the banners were made from photographs of individual quills. So the quills reference two of the four sacred medicines for Indigenous people here on Turtle Island. So one of them is sweetgrass and the other one is cedar. The banners are very colorful and bold. And I've accompanied them with some spirals, ceiling to floor spirals that are rotated by a motor. And the surface design on those silk spirals is made up of individual photographs of moss, moss being the first plants on the planet. But it also, when you look at the breathing holes on the underside of leaves, which are stomata, and you look at those under high resolution scanning electron microscopes, it looks like you're looking at moss. So that kind of gave me the idea that I wanted to photograph the moss, print it on the textiles, and then the stomata are actually look like orifices. They look like either a mouth or like a vulva, a human vulva. They really are the mouths, like the breathing holes, but they also are in some ways, they give birth to us, right? Because they provide us with volatile organic compounds, and they also, which we breathe in, and they also filter the air of carbon dioxide and provide us with oxygen. So my cousin, who is the chair of oral history at the University of Manitoba, his name is Warren Cario. He also is a photographer and an artist, and he wrote a wonderful essay that ties my work to our family history and centers it in the Indigenous storytelling culture that is part of who the Métis people are.
Do you have plans to tour the exhibit or plans to make something new in the future? If so, where and what?
The exhibit just came here from Fort Calgary. Not all the pieces were in it, but this show has kind of been on the road throughout COVID. It was showed in part at the Dunlop Gallery in Regina. And then it moved to Fort Calgary and then came to the Mai. And each time I've enriched it with new pieces. So this actual show that's here now at the Mai has never been shown before, but some of the works have been shown elsewhere. And definitely because I think the work is a great opportunity to share stories and to create space for Métis history, I would very much like to show the works elsewhere if that opportunity presents, and I'm actively working on that.
If our listeners want more information about the gallery or the exhibition, where should they go?
They should probably just consult the MAI, Montréal Art Interculturel website, MAI. I think the MAI has put up a Facebook page for the show. So that is, I think probably they would do, you know, MAI, Daphne Boyer. They could enter the title, Fakur, that's F-A, second word, Q-U-E, and they would find me. There might be some Instagram links as well. But the thing to look for is the, you know, look for the MAI, and also remember the date. The launch is on September 8th at 5 o'clock, 5 to 7 or 8 o'clock. There's, you know, everyone's welcome. Bring your friends and come out and enjoy the opportunity to see some unusual and bold Indigenous art.
Daphne, if our listeners want to get in touch with you and buy some of your artwork, where should they go?
I have a website. You can just find me at daphneboye.com. I also am on Instagram at Daphne B. Boye. So either way would be great. They can connect with me through those two digital means. Yeah.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
Great. Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's great. And thank you for your work.
You've been listening to Daphne Boye speaking about Fakur, her art exhibition at the Mai. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
J'ai trouvé des fleurs séchées dans mon char. Trois semaines après que t'aies cueilli bouquet. Ma chambre sent le velours et le fort. Relent de ce qu'on était. T'avais caché son rouge à lèvres dans ton tiroir. Le jour où tu m'avais bouquet. C'était trop peu, trop tard. Déjà nos pétales fermés. La corde est dans l'entrée, je t'attends. Une heure de retard, c'est pas impressionnant.
me déchire fort sur les restes de ce qu'on était. Le bouquet brûle, j'en veux encore.